He's been involved in a lot of litigation. He's sued the state several times regarding enforcement issues. He defends clients in front of the administrative actions and through the AG's office. He's here, like I said, today to talk about the regulatory scheme in Colorado and some of the problems. Please help me welcome Sean McAllister.
Well, welcome to Aspen, Colorado. As Jerry said, welcome to the free state of Colorado, a place that I moved to in 1996. This is a crossroads of the nation. We sit, you know, in the middle of the country. Literally, our mountains split the country from east to west. And this is where people come as a community of choice to create a new culture, to create a new society. And that's what we have here in Colorado. And I'm so proud to have been a part of this over the last 20 years. And so. I now have a six-lawyer law firm in Denver that does, we have two missions. We ameliorate the negative effects of the war on drugs. That's our first mission in the criminal justice world. And number two, we're helping to build a new industry with the marijuana industry. But it really, it's come a long way in the last 20 years. And I'll just take a minute to give you my personal background. And I've got great mentors like Lenny Freeling in the audience and, of course, Keith Straub. But in 1996, I go to law school at the University of Colorado in Boulder. What happened in 96? California passes legalized medical marijuana. You know, I came to this state to be an environmental attorney, but really, even though we have very little diversity in Colorado, we do have a strong passion for social justice in this state. And that's really what lit my fire in 96. One of my best friends in law school quits law school after one semester. Screw this, I'm going to California. He moves to the Bay Area, starts to grow in Berkeley, you know, pimps out with Dr. Seussian, style, this little house in Berkeley, filled it full of weed, started supplying dispensaries. That evolved into a 10,000 square foot warehouse. And I mean, the world really revolutionized in front of my eyes in 1996 because of California, because of Matt Cumin and all the great people. I get to meet, you know, Debbie Goldsberry in California and Wayne Justman and some of the old school people. Terrence Howeman at the time was the DA, and he came out in favor of legalized marijuana. So, I'm one of these people that Allen Ginsberg says, I smoke marijuana every chance I get. And, back in the day, that was certainly my mentality, and to see this legalized mentality that we had was revolutionary. And, you know, I got on that wave. We intended to fight just the drug war in general, but obviously marijuana was the lowest hanging fruit. I mean, my God, if we can't legalize this substance, this is pathetic. And so I'm very proud to have been part of some of the efforts here in Colorado. I will pump you up with some of the good news at first, because, you know, I am one of those 90-10 guys. I spend 90% of my time on the 10% of shit that's fucked up. But the truth is, 90% of it is pretty awesome. So just listen to these stats for you out-of-staters. You probably know some of these already. But 2014, first full year of legalization of marijuana in Colorado, we had $700 million in retail sales. We had half of that is medical, half of that is recreational. So $350 million in each realm. You had about $60 million in tax revenue. You know, I actually was against the taxes that these 20% taxes they put on marijuana, but we turned out to pretty much, I was wrong about the taxes. I thought the number would be higher. The projections are we will be at about $94 million in taxes every year by 2016. So, you know, in all these states that have these budget deficits, $100 million a year is not chump change. That's a lot of money. So doing well on that. We got 2,200 licensed businesses. We have over 10,000 jobs in the marijuana industry. And Colorado has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the nation. We have 150,000 pounds of marijuana sold last year.
Yeah.
5.5 million edibles sold last year. 98% occupancy rates in our warehouse districts in Denver and the Front Range. I mean, you've got these piece of shit old warehouses that you probably used to pay 30 and 40 bucks a square foot for. 1940s, 50s, and 60s vintage crap pieces of warehouses that are now going for 80, 90 bucks a square foot. I mean, these landlords are rolling in the dough. They are selling warehouses at 50% over valuation just because of the locations. And with this industry has minted real estate money for this state. We've got marijuana arrests that used to be 13,000 a year in Colorado, down 90% since 2010. I mean, this is the mission that Keith set out on and all these other founders in this industry, in this movement, and we have achieved it in this state. We have crime is down in Denver. I mean, you know, all the naysayers who said that the sky was going to fall, obviously it didn't. And we have record tourism. We had 64 million tourists last year, spent $18 billion in our state, and clearly the sky has not fallen, right? So that's something to be proud of. Can we give a hand to that?
Yes.
Okay, so what do we all do? I mean, all my great friends in this crowd, I mean, all of us are fighters. We all stand up to injustice. The basic bottom line is I came from the criminal defense world. I always say my clients used to be criminals, now they're entrepreneurs. And you know, the bottom line is what we do in whatever world we work in, the criminal defense world or the regulatory world, is we do the same thing. You know, we stand up to the king. The king is inattentive to his subjects. The king looks at us and casts down the verdict of this person is bad, he must be punished. And we stand up for the individual to make that person humanized, to make them viewed in the light of who they are and what their circumstances are. But at the same time, we stand up to say, look at this person or this company in the context of the whole. And so there is never going to be an end to this injustice. And that's what I found in my work in the regulatory regime, is that we have a stupid, idiotic, a bureaucratic regulator that is a bumbling, mumbling, schizophrenic regulator that is going to be, it's going to create injustice. And, you know, I'm just really proud to be part of a group like this, that is what we do day in and day out, as we stand up to that injustice. And so, you know, that has manifested itself in many ways over the last 5 years. The evolution of this, obviously, is 2010. We get a formal law in Colorado saying you can have dispensaries. You know, my clients in 2008, 2009 just went out and cocked a shotgun and said, let's do this. You know, let's open up our doors. But in reality, we didn't have a law till 2010. So a little bit of the evolution, and then I'll talk about some of my recent litigation. But in the evolution of this process, I mean, we are bringing this product out of the black market in this environment of law enforcement mentality, you know, law enforcement perspective on marijuana. Marijuana is dangerous, it must be controlled. And so in 2011 and 12, I was still defending people in criminal cases. People were opening up dispensaries, and in particular in conservative jurisdictions like Colorado Springs, you had police knocking down the doors, coming in saying, you know, show us your papers, how many plants do you have? And ultimately arresting people. I ended up doing 4 or 5 cases in Colorado Springs where, you know, they promised us a seed-to-sale regulatory regime, right? Well, there was an audit in 2013. It's just that if any of your states are developing marijuana, you really need to get it right from the beginning. We kind of took this, I think Governor Hickenlooper just looked at marijuana and said, well, I don't want this, you know, I'm not going to take it too serious. I'm going to appoint some cop to the head of this agency and we'll underfund it and it won't be a big deal. I mean, we were promised a seed-to-sale regulation system. They spent $1.1 million on this tracking system and then abandoned the effort because it was too expensive. They bought more cars than they had employees. They bought all these hybrid SUVs, more SUVs than they had employees. They bankrupted themselves in the first 2 years of the regulation. So the industry was in an environment of basically unregulated reality. They were just out there in good faith. The regulators told them, hey, we want you to do good faith, substantial compliance. If we come in and some things are wrong, you know, we'll work with you. We understand it's a new industry. And that was the environment in the early days of this industry. But you had local jurisdictions stepping in saying, no, you know, we're Colorado Springs. This is, you know, we want to be serious about this. They would come in, bust people, and say, you got too many plants. Well, what was the system in those years? Patients would come in, and they would give a card, and they would say, I want just you to be my dispensary. You can grow my plants. And that would, they would do that because they would get a discount on marijuana. The next day, they'd go to a different dispensary, get a different discount, and assign this different dispensary to grow their plants. Meanwhile, Dispensary A had no idea that they had changed because, again, the state had not created that seed-to-sale system yet. They couldn't track where the patients were. So the bottom line is, you know, I actually had to go to trial in Colorado Springs with a dispensary owner, and she was the lead defendant in about four or five cases, and we totally got all an acquittal on all charges because we told that jury, yeah, the jury realized that no human being could know how many plants they were supposed to have. This system is totally fallible. But there was an example early in the game where local jurisdictions were taking strong enforcement actions, and we've seen that consistently over the years, and I'm going to talk about what Denver's done recently. But, you know, where state regulation fails, or where it's perceived to be failing, the locals will step in and try to take enforcement actions. So that was one of the early things that we did to try to defend people, and as a result of that one acquittal, all the other four cases got dismissed. They haven't prosecuted any dispensary owners for that type of thing since. And we did get, finally, the seed-to-sale tracking system, which is still imperfect. But so that was something early in the game. But, you know, in the big picture, what happened is we had four directors of this agency over the first 5 years of its existence. And so, like I said earlier, we had a very law enforcement mentality. We still have it. We have cops running our regulation. And we have cops who are trying to explain operating agreements and promissory notes and, you know, business transactions and convertible equity notes and all these things we're trying to do. And that's a problem. I think it's fundamentally wrong. You know, we should have business people in charge of that agency who understand the needs of business and what it takes to, because ultimately one of the messages I think I have is, and I have clients now in New York and Oregon and Nevada and Alaska and, you know, around the country. I'm not one of these groups that's trying to have a national practice, but I've got specific clients that are around the country. I mean, what you're seeing is really regulation to death. I think the bastards are killing us from within. You know, they couldn't win at the ballot. They hate marijuana, and so they're going to take every penny of profit out of this thing by regulation in every way they can. They're going to over-regulate it to the hilt. I mean, my concern is that we're regulating marijuana like plutonium, not like alcohol. And that's true. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, we had that substantial good faith compliance mentality in Colorado early in the game. And then in 2013, there was a new director appointed, and he did what I call the New Year's Eve massacre. On December 31st, 2013, he issued 131 denial letters to dispensaries. Because the new sheriff was in town, and goddamn it, he was going to be tough, and he issued a bunch of those of those denial letters. And look, the bottom line is, I was talking to somebody recently about this. You know, yes, some dispensary owners make mistakes. You know, I've got examples just in the last 6 months of people that were running out of product, and they had an employee who had a bunch of weed at home, and they had to bring it in because they were running out of product. I mean, these are stupid decisions, but these are not triggering the fundamental concerns of the federal government about black market activity or selling to kids. These are bad business decisions, and I was telling somebody the other day, you know, yes, it's mostly a cash business, and I'm sure, you know, there's some shenanigans going on with the cash, but how many plumbers are reporting all their income? How many lawyers have reported every penny of income they've ever been given? I mean, you know, if anybody looked at any industry under a microscope, you're going to see some problems. And my complaint overall with the regulator is that they have shut down dispensary after dispensary for basic mismanagement. Mismanagement that doesn't arise to the level of endangering public safety or selling to kids or doing those things. And so I did want to take a minute, you know, that is really, when you talk to our regulator, they say, well, look, we've got the federal 8-point memo that we're gonna be serious about these issues, and that's why we're shutting people down, as if they're triggering some of those concerns in the 8-point memo, the Cole memo and the other federal memos that talked about black market activity, connection to cartels. So I wanted to just review where some of that is at. Well, it's really a mixed bag. I mean, you know, I am defending the only guy in Colorado indicted in federal court, the VIP cannabis raids from November 2013. I'm defending the principal owner in that case. And so I have some sense of what the federal government is interested in. I mean, that case, and all of this is public record, is really bullshit at the end of the day. I mean, you know, the bottom line is they said it was Colombian cartels and guys with guns and all that is fantasy. You know, the bottom line is I think the federal government wanted to step in, show it was tough, give an enforcement action, show that it could still do this. But if you look at those 8 criteria they set out, I think the evidence is mixed right now. I mean, you know, unfortunately, DUIDs are up 50% since, you know, 2014. Now, of course, Paul and I and others, everybody in this room has been fighting these stupid DUID laws, and we know that 5 nanograms is not a fair standard, and cops are biased towards it. There's also the other side of it, that patients and users are more open about their marijuana use, and so it's not really surprising that DUID is up, but it is up on paper. Kid use is stable overall. There haven't been any direct cartel links. That, again, there's no proof of that. No evidence of it being a front for organized crime. Diversion to other states, you know. I think, Lauren said, be careful what you say. I mean, unfortunately, this is an issue. I mean, we have a private home grow right in this state, and we have caregivers in this state that can get a recommendation from a doctor to grow 100 plants, some of them more. And there's no doubt in my mind, I'm defending, you know, people all over the state, that I think all this should be legal, and it's ridiculous that anybody's criminalized for growing a plant. But at the end of the day, there are limits to this, and I think the caregiver system does bleed out marijuana to other states. And, you know, they're trying to take steps to address that. I'm going to talk about that at the end. I think some of the crackdown is, you know, leading towards that they limited the number of plants caregivers could have. They limited the number they could have in warehouses. They taken aggressive things to ban in-home butane hash production by private individuals. I mean, these are showing gaps in the regulatory system. You know what we need? We need the ability to have a company that processes your hash into or processes your trim into hash. I mean, why can't we do that? There's no legal system right now to do that. So because of that, people are making the logical choice to try to do it themselves. And, you know, one of my clients blew himself up in Eagle County recently trying to do it himself. But when you're faced with $60, $80 a gram for hash, people will start looking for alternatives. And unfortunately, you know, that's led to some problems. But looking at these 8 priorities, again, you know, possession on federal property, I think, is up. I've had to defend a lot more people growing on federal lands around Colorado. And but on the good side, you know, fatal crashes are flat. So, I mean, the bag here is mixed. I think it's why somebody said earlier we have a really big responsibility to do this right, because there is no guarantees what the federal government's going to do. But right now, the picture from the federal enforcement priority is mixed, and I'm a little concerned about that. Let me talk about a couple of the dumb state provisions, and then I'll talk about some of these recent lawsuits. So we have really stupid rules in this state. One of them is you have to be a resident for 2 years to be an owner. There's only a couple states in the nation that have that kind of rule. Washington State has a short, I think it's a 1-day residency restriction. I think Oregon's talking about a residency restriction. But, you know, I've been looking at suing over this. It's a really difficult thing to do. It's a rational relation review, and it's going to be tough to win. But the bottom line is that rule has limited investment into this industry so significantly, and it's also at the same time pushed a lot of the shenanigans and the, you know, the backdoor deals and the off-record deals. And they need to fix that, because at the end of the day, that rule makes us not only non-competitive with other states, but it also drives some of the shenanigans we see. And that extends to the point where it's so stupid that if I loan you money and you promise to pay me back, I can't even have a security interest in the equipment of your business. So you got $1 million worth of lights, I want to give you $1 million. If you don't pay me back, I can't get your equipment. Any other lender would be able to get a security interest in your property, but not in this industry, because it's viewed as ownership. It's ownership that I can get your fixtures, furniture, equipment if you don't pay me back. I mean, these kind of stupid rules. If you're a grower, you cannot have you can't be paid a price per pound unless you're listed as an owner. I mean, the rules have changed so many times, and these rules are anti-competitive, and they're really, again, an example of law enforcement mentality, not business mentality, that we have in our regulator in this state. And you get these crazy concoctions where, again, you can't, Tommy Chong, I did this deal with Tommy Chong, he's an out-of-state resident and a felon, so he definitely can't be an owner. But we can pay him a royalty fee of 5-6 figures a month, whatever we decide on, every single month. So you just get these crazy concoctions of deals that are driven by stupid regulations. And I think, you know, in these other states, it's not as big of a problem, but that's an example of that law enforcement mentality creating stupidity. So let's talk about a couple of these cases recently that I've taken against the state. I got to see the great Larry Posner talk a couple weeks ago, and obviously I'm a tenth of the hundredth of the speaker he is, but you know, he really fired me up by talking about, you know, a lot of times what we do is our victory is standing up for our clients. Our victory is entering that appearance and standing next to a condemned person or standing, or you know, someone accused of something and saying, no, this isn't right, this isn't fair. And so I use that as a preface to say I've lost most of these lawsuits, but God damn it, I've stood up to the bastards. Because, you know, the bottom line is, again, I want marijuana regulated like alcohol or any other industry. And what happens in this industry is, like I said, some mismanagement, some sloppiness, the camera wasn't pointed in the right direction, the log wasn't filled out the right way. You know, a guy has poured his entire life savings into this dispensary. He's borrowed all his parents' money from their 401k. And we're talking about most people have put at least $2 to $3 million into these dispensaries over the last 6 years. And the myth of the pot baron is ridiculous. I mean, 90% of the people have made almost no money. They're just getting by, you know, trying to build to that next level, putting all the money into the grow. So they make some mistakes along the way. The regulator comes in and says, God damn it, you didn't have your camera in the right place. You're going to lose your license. Not only lose your license, you'll lose your entire investment. Not only that, you can't sell the license because we're going to prohibit you from doing that. So, you know, we've stood up to them a couple times. There's a bigger firm not to be named in the state that never sues the regulator. I mean, my attitude is you got to stand up to them and eventually make your point through some of this litigation. So there was, as I said, this audit in 2013 that said the regulator was very sloppy in its enforcement procedure. And actually, there was an injunction granted against the regulator, the Marijuana Enforcement Division, the MED. In 2013, there was an injunction granted saying you got to give an applicant a chance to submit some information to say what the screw-up was and why they screwed up. And so there was one example of a victory there. And after that case, you know, I came in and said, okay, well, it's not enough to just give us the opportunity to give you some information. You got to give us a hearing before you shut us down. Because they would just come in, shut the whole thing down, and close the dispensary and destroy the investment. And my argument was due process under the Administrative Procedure Act required to give somebody a hearing before you shut them down. They wouldn't do this in an alcohol business. They wouldn't come in and just shut it down. Again, these are examples where there was no threat to public safety, no black marketing, just some mismanagement. Well, you know, we lost that hearing in early 2014. But, you know, my attitude is, okay, let's try a different theory. So we didn't win that one. So then we said, okay, if you don't have to give us a hearing, then at least you got to give us a chance to fix the problem. Because there's some specific language in the State Administrative Procedures Act that says licensees should have the opportunity to remedy the violation before they lose their license. Again, I think it's indicative of the hostile judicial environment that we did lose that case also. But I think through those two cases last year, you saw, you know, I'm not taking full credit for this, but you saw a change in enforcement philosophy. The regulator said, geez, okay, well now I kind of see their point. Maybe they should be able to fix the problem, or maybe they should be able to have some remedy before we just shut them down and take the license away. And you know, then my cases, in addition to probably a lot of other cases, led the regulator to change its policy last year to where now they really are moving forward with this thing called assurance of voluntary compliance. It means that if you promise you won't screw up again and you pay us a fine, we won't shut you down, we won't take your license away. And they have changed their enforcement policy. So, you know, I'm proud on that level. I think my suits have had some effect of helping change the enforcement philosophy there. And they have been more cooperative lately, so that's really good. And yeah, how long do I have till 10:30?
10:30.
All right, we're doing good then. So that brings us to pesticides. Another in a long line of Orwellian, Lewis Carroll type down the rabbit hole only in marijuana logic comes this issue of pesticides. I mean, look, I'm an environmentalist. I don't like pesticides. I don't like any of this stuff. But the fact is, it's all around us. It's on your food. It's on stuff you eat every single day. And there are, you know, scientific studies that give acceptable limits of what can be on stuff that goes into your body. So this is another example. The state regulator has done absolutely nothing on this. They, was looking for some water, but super dry here.
Okay.
Somebody can give me one there. Sorry about that. I've been kind of sick this week, so thanks for bearing with me. But let's talk about this. So the bottom line is there was no state rule on pesticide levels in marijuana. We weren't smart enough to set that out in the beginning. And in the void, the local jurisdiction stepped in again. And Denver started coming in to dispensaries. They investigated 60 dispensaries out of the several hundred of them. Oh, thank you so much. They came into 60 of them and shut down 11, including the largest dispensary, I think, in the state, Livewell, which has 15 dispensaries and a 100,000 square foot grow and 60,000 plants, all put on hold. But a lot of other mom and pop shops that, again, poured all their life savings, everything into this. And I think, and one of the things I like to brag about to my clients and to everybody is that, hey, look, I used to be a grower. In law school, I grew weed. It's hard. It's hard to grow good pop. You know, I had all the problems. I had the spider mites and the fungus and all that crap. I mean, and you know, I finally got it right, but it's a hard thing to do. So you had the black market, gray market growers coming into the regulated world. They did exactly what they did when they were in their basement. They went and talked to people at the garden nursery shop and said, how do I control mold? Oh, well, you control mold with this thing, Eagle 20. It's a fungicide, and it's actually approved for use on edible products. It's approved for use on grapes and on peaches and plums and stone fruits, and there's acceptable levels of it on all sorts of products we eat every single day, on lettuce, on hops, which goes into your beer. There's tons of acceptable uses for this stuff. So,
did you argue, because this was a current matter, did you argue that Eagle 20 then was safe?
It is safe. Here's the problem with it. The only marijuana logic is that there is no, how are pesticides regulated? By EPA. EPA does risk assessment studies on pesticides. But of course, there is no pesticide risk assessment on marijuana because EPA won't allow it. So what pesticide is approved by EPA for marijuana? None. There are no approved pesticides for marijuana. So what does a commercial grow do in that context? Like I said, they look at other comparable things. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's the conundrum that these people were placed in. That the Colorado Department of Agriculture created a arbitrary list of about 200 pesticides and fungicides that they think are okay. Well, none of those 200 are also approved on marijuana, but they used, like, some label language that said, oh, this could be used for rooting plant or for potted plants such as petunias. Well, they said, oh, because it says such as, that means there could be other things it could be safe for. But the bottom line is, you know, at the end of the day, they found tiny fractions of this substance on one of my client's product. We went all the way to a preliminary injunction hearing that lasted 4 days. It was supposed to last 4 hours. And really, I think what we showed is that we had two toxicologists come in and say, you could have smoked 4,000 joints of my client's marijuana with this level of this microbutanol on it and still not even be at a risk level. I mean, this was thousands of times lower than what a risk level was. But again, you're in an environment of a hostile judiciary and a city saying, hey, we have the right to regulate. This is like bad chicken in a restaurant. If there's contaminated product, we can do it. We argued the city didn't have the jurisdiction. It had to be the Colorado Department of Agriculture because the Med was nowhere to be found on this issue. The state agency charge that actually has a list of prohibited substances of pesticides was nowhere to be found on this issue. There wasn't any enforcement action by them. But at the end of the day, the judge said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to step in. Again, this is another example. You use litigation sometimes to educate the regulator, because I think we did educate the regulator in that context that their rules are arbitrary, that the standards were that this stuff was safe, and they're now reconsidering it, and they are releasing some products at certain levels. And my client got 60 pounds of his marijuana released last week after the litigation ended.
What was the underlying basis for the raid?
Well, I think there's a lot of tattletaling in this industry, not only by employees on their employers when they get fired, but on one dispensary to another. Hey, that guy's doing that bad thing. And so they haven't visited all 200 dispensaries in Denver. They went to 60 of them, and it was based on complaints that we saw some pesticides there. The Denver Fire Department was doing inspections, and they were kind of keeping a lookout for it.
How would that have happened without the participation of the MED? I didn't understand that when that story broke.
Well, the city of Denver considers itself to have authority to protect the public health of its citizens. So when the fire department came in and said they saw these pesticides, again, in the void, without state regulation, the city decided it was its job to make sure this stuff was safe. My sense of the Med, I mean, they're slower now than ever. They're overwhelmed again for some reason. I think they're ramping up enforcement actions from what I can tell. I'm getting a lot more enforcement cases. So, you know, this is, you know, marijuana is the ugly stepchild. We get second-class citizenship every single day in the courts, in the administrative agencies. These people, every chance they get to kick us, they're going to do it. I mean, these city regulators, they want to stand up and pound their chest. We protected public health. We shut this grow down. Look how good we did. You know, even though there's no science behind it, even though it's not true, it's, you know, it's a very hard argument. Judges hear pesticide on marijuana, they freak out. And so we've got a mayor of Denver that's hostile to marijuana. He's openly said, I'm going to do everything I can to limit this. I mean, he doesn't like it. So for me, it comes right from him top down. And, you know, I think it's an example of the industry gets treated like a stepchild and gets beat around and beat up every chance it gets. So yeah, let me talk about a couple other regulatory issues out there, and we'll leave a little bit of time for questioning. Thanks for putting up with me. I know I haven't been very funny. Usually funny looking, but not funny. So look, I think what I said earlier is they're doing crazy things right now. You've got, again, they're going to suck the life out of this in every way they can. So we can buy an ounce of marijuana in recreational if you're an in-state resident, a quarter if you're out of state. Of course, that's per transaction. So if you're from out of state, you can buy a quarter at one dispensary, go to another, buy a quarter, come back to the first one a couple hours later, depending on how liberal the dispensary is. Legally, I think per transaction means they could sell you a quarter now and 2 hours later sell you another quarter. But anyways, we got these rules. And now they say, oh, hash is such a problem, we got to control hash. So we need an equivalency rate for hash compared to marijuana. So they're talking about now, you know, right now you can buy an ounce of hash. Shit, that's a lot of hash. Grams an ounce, 250-something grams. So now they're talking about limiting hash purchases to 2 grams. That would have a huge impact on, you know, concentrate producers, and it's expensive to do those things. So they're trying to get a hold of that. They've got these, you know, crazy limits now. If you think about the regulatory impacts of some of the laws, they've got this limit that says you can only have on hand the inventory that you sold, the equivalent of what you sold in the last quarter. So this is another dumb example of regulation driving market, that if you have a state, you know, don't make a rule like this, because what it means is that if you sold 100 pounds in the last quarter and you've got 500 pounds on hand, then you're running up to the end of the quarter, you know, Jesus, if I don't sell, you know, all 500 pounds of this by the end of the quarter, I'm not going to be able to possess that amount the next quarter. So these, you know, we're going to have a huge drop in price with the huge grows that are coming online, the overproduction. There were 320,000 plants a month last year being cultivated in Colorado. That was 50% of the capacity of the system. So 600,000 plants at any one time is potential right now, maybe more, because that was last year's statistics. And these are ways in which, why do we have to have an inventory limit? You're worried about backdoor black market activity if there's too much product on hand. Everything's on camera. I mean, how stupid would somebody be to black market hundreds of pounds out the back door when it's all on camera? I mean, these are dumb rules that drive dumb results and will affect the market. We still don't have statewide pesticide contamination, so I think we're going to still see this kind of local regulation stepping into the void on that. And that's an example. Why can't the regulator get it together after all these years? It shouldn't be that hard. We did create a felony, again, recriminalization of marijuana. This is what, you know, our crazy whacktivist left-wing marijuana should be free and no regulation people all said about us, is that, oh, you're just going to replace one criminal system for another. Well, they did re-felonize the home production of hash this year and make it a felony to create hash at home. I mean, again, why don't we have a place people can go or a business you can create to process hash for people? That seems like an easy solution. They are, as I said earlier, they're cracking down on caregivers. My firm is about to sue the city of Denver over the 36-plant limit in Denver for caregivers. There's already been one lawsuit tried by our friend Rob Corey on that. It's lost, but we think there's some new grounds, some different grounds. Here's the question: is the Constitution says you can have as much marijuana as is medically necessary. Your doctor tells you you can have 100 plants, but the city of Denver says there's no legal place in the city where you can do that. You can only grow 12 plants at home, and now only 36 in a warehouse. So we're going to see more criminalization of that in-home production, trying to drive everybody towards the regulated market. Look, I'm one of those lawyers. I'm in both worlds. I support dispensaries and home production and caregiver people. I think we ought to have both. And so I think it'll be interesting to see if some of those limits are upheld. But yeah, a couple other comments, and then I'll shut up, is, you know, again, the myth that our people are getting rich is just wrong. At the end of the day, you know, people are paying 50, 60% effective tax rates. I think if anybody came to me and said, I want to get into this industry, I'd almost discourage them just because it's so crazy. It's not if, it's a matter of when in the state of Colorado that you'll get in trouble. And we have this, like I said earlier, one of my complaints with the regulator is they come in on some dispensaries and there's mismanagement and those people are losing their life savings. But LiveWell, one of the biggest dispensaries in the state, accidentally poisons. You can't poison somebody with marijuana, but they gave out marijuana at a county fair, and they said it was unmedicated. It was medicated. Some people freaked out, went to the hospital. They paid a fine. All they did was pay a fine. Another group, one that I represented, blew up a shed and almost killed somebody doing open blasting in a shed last year of butane when they shouldn't have been doing that. And they also paid a fine. So I that's my complaint about the regulations, the regulators. You can't tell why is this guy the bad guy and this guy can keep their license. There's a lot of, you know, suspicion that there's some backroom things going on. I don't really know, but I think it's very subjective. And it's a very dangerous industry to be in because you have one low-level employee who does a stupid thing and you can lose your whole life's investment. I'm in some of these other states, and, you know, to me, the more they overregulate this stuff, why do we need to weigh our waste? Why don't we just destroy it? Why do we need to keep record of the weight of our waste? And why do we need to mulch it? We're putting it in locked canisters, locked waste canisters. There's so much overregulation in this industry that how can we survive? I mean, New York, it's a $200,000 application fee. And they're going to give a monopoly to five people, and you know, you've got to be a $20 million group to get in. So I'm worried that the trend here is continued overregulation to destroy us from within. But all that being said, it's a pretty great day in Colorado.